Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday. Today is April 14th, 2007. As you all know, we are weekly from 3 to 4 p.m. It's now daylight savings time in eastern United States, and we're live for this hour. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and I will moderate today, where our topic, as you have seen, may have seen been advertised, is bringing on the nuclear renaissance. Now, I would like to announce our guests and then get right into it. And in the studio, we have today a great longtime friend of mine, Ramtanu Maitra. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Tanu is associated with Executive Intelligence Review, goes back and forth to India very frequently on strategic matters and physical economic matters. But Tanu, you first trained formally, I understand, in nuclear engineering or nuclear physics.
Yes, I started off as a structural engineer, but then I turned myself into a nuclear engineer at the time. Nuclear was on its way out. Yeah.
And so now we're glad to have him when it's on its way in.
Right,
and to discuss that, I also welcome Cody Jones, who's speaking to us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Cody.
Hello.
And you also hail from California. Where are you not co-chairman? Is that the right title for the Franklin Delano Roosevelt Legacy Club in the Democratic Party in Orange County?
That's right. Or in L.A. County.
L.A. County. And you're here from California. But a colleague of yours from Northern California in Oakland in the LaRouche Youth Movement is with us. Ben Denniston. Welcome, Ben.
Hello.
You're in Oakland?
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
So by way of the shortest kind of introduction, I remind people if they've been, and I hope they've been looking periodically, many times a day, at the LaRouche Political Action Committee website, LaRouchePAC.com, and they'll be seeing in recent days, in the last couple of weeks, LaRouche stressing the priority of initiatives by the four major powers who could put the world back together again, in terms of the physical economy and the nation states of the world. I mean the United States, Russia, China, and India, this is of utmost importance, any direction of initiatives from these people, despite Cheney and Bush still being in Washington and other things taking place, that this can make all the difference into the future of civilization. I'm not exaggerating. And a foremost part of any of the initiatives for the good by the nations I'm describing is to start to resume a nuclear power program for energy, for technology, for everything. And in fact, I'd like people to look in the next couple of days for a new paper Mr. LaRouche is finishing right now as we're gathering. It's called Where the Future Lies. And he's enjoying pointing out that former U.S. Vice President Al Gore's popularity may be very quickly on the wane, that is, on the way out. And this whole biofuels itself has been biofoolery, it's been swindles, it's all based on that kind of thing. And the question is, what among thinking circles of leadership around the world is who's going to control the economic policies of a world in which nuclear fission and related technologies will be taking over? Mm-hmm. Those are some of LaRouche's words. So what I'd like to do is start with looking at the world picture somewhat empirically. Because we left off 30, 40 years ago with the plans for which we had 60 years ago for Atoms for Peace, of having dozens of nuclear plants in the world. Mm-hmm. So today we only have about 435. We have 103 or so operating in the United States. If you add in France and Japan, you account for two-thirds of all the nuclear plants in the world. But Tanu, you've been following very carefully that out of Eurasia, in Russia and India, as well as China, there have been announcements for dozens of new plants. Could you fill us in?
Yes, but before I start that, you brought up the Atoms for Peace. That's interesting to me because I was a high school student in Calcutta at the time when this Atom for Peace ship came on the river Ganga, Ganges, and our school trooped in to see there, and I still remember only thing I really remember is that the size of the peanuts, you know, in that were in the jar, and these are the, you know, radiated ones. Yes, the India, China in particular are now gearing up for a nuclear, putting in nuclear reactors. Russia, you know, already is pretty much in the front line of reactor building, and they are mostly looking for selling reactors than for setting up new ones for their own use. They do have plenty of gas, and they have plenty of oil, and they have reactors. So the Russian reactors will play a very important role in building the energy program in India and China, and also to build Russia's relationship with India and China on the basis of something very important and concrete.
So this is a kind of triangular...
It's a triangular relationship that fits in very well because of Russia's capability to produce a large size and a large number of reactors at any point in time.
And what are some of the dimensions of this? I understand in Zhangzhou in China, one of the biggest reactors is being built along with Russia. And,
yes.
You know, and how many are to be built in India and so forth and so on?
The Indian program has been is always... given out in advance a lot more than the Chinese program. The Chinese program, as of now, they have in place, they're saying that they're putting out three reactors, 3,000 megawatt reactors they are going to buy right away. And I think that their plan is to set up eight of those 1,000 megawatt reactors in the coming, you know, 5 or 6 years. The Indian program is a lot more ambitious than that. Indian program is also a lot more interesting than the Chinese program because Chinese are going ahead to put in these light water reactors, pressurized light water reactors, which they were going to buy from outside. Although they are working at this point in time with the pebble bed reactors and more advanced and high temperature reactors. The Indian program is, at this point, they're saying that by next 2 years, they will be starting 12 reactors, and three of them are fast breeder reactors, and eight of them are a 700 megawatt pressurized heavy water reactor, and one of them is a light water reactor. That's the program which will add up to total of 10,000 megawatts in the nuclear program. But India's plan is that in next 10 years, which will take you to 2017, total addition to energy is about 200,000 megawatt. That's what they're planning. And that's a lot of...
And so just to stay again on the dimensions, the profile, which in other words, if you take the United States now, where we've been static and declining for decades, about 20% of our electricity is from nuclear power. In India, as of now, what?
It's only 4%.
And then by 2017, it would be?
It will be, I think it will go up to 8 or 9. But then, I think at that point in time, it will be all nuclear in another.
After that. You would start to phase out the fossil fuel?
Yeah, because we'll be utilizing most of the hydroelectric. Hydroelectric, India has a lot of capabilities. And they have not done, some 84,000 megawatts can be done of hydroelectric feasible. coal, almost unlimited amount, but now the mining activities are getting pretty rough because it's getting pretty deep mines. So they are going to use the coal for other purposes than for power generation. The fertilizer is necessary and all that.
So this is a whole... This is a whole advancing of the kind of physical economic direction
yes.
to start to put
finally,
on a higher...
Finally, yes.
And it's come about in recent months and years.
Yes. I think that there is a, in the Indian context, I must say that the Chinese developmental plans and the Chinese advancement of its industry has given the Indians an impetus to go ahead and do it. Otherwise, they are going to be completely drowned by the Chinese products and things like that. So, and also there is no question that Indians have also realized that that the Indians have the capabilities to do this. At the same time, the triangular relationship between China, India, and Russia has opened up opportunities for getting raw material, intermediate materials, and things like that, which would otherwise, you know, in the Cold War days, were very difficult to obtain.
I think one of the examples, maybe of what you said, that's on today's LaRouche PAC site, is that there was an announcement of collaboration to develop the uranium ore reserves in Mongolia by China and Russia.
Right, right. I think that Russian program and the Chinese nuclear program are entirely based on uranium as of now. And even if they go for pebble bed reactors, I think they're going to put uranium-235. And if the Indians go for pebble bed reactors, which they have not planned as yet, but I heard discussions among the scientists about that, and they said that thorium works just fine also. But I think that enormous amount of research work is necessary, developmental work is necessary for thorium to be used in pebble bed.
Well, let's take one thing at a time, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I wanted to ask Cody and Ben at this point about some important points of this. And then what you're talking about, which that is thorium, that mm-hmm. is this other element mm-hmm. that has a breeding relationship to getting into uranium and so mm-hmm. forth. We'd like you to develop that. But first, Cody, you've personally conferred with people working on an analog to the pebble bed or the high temperature fourth generation nuclear designs
that are
in California. What do you think? What do you find needs to be brought out here that's the kind of need-to-know thing for people in any part of the world that wants to understand more about what should be pushed ahead technically here?
Well, I think the biggest point, I guess when you're discussing questions of nuclear power, particularly as it comes up now against what's being proposed as these alternative fuels, biofuels or solar or wind, is people need to get a much more thorough understanding of physical economy as Lyndon LaRouche understands it, that the advantage, particularly of nuclear power, is that you're able to achieve a much higher density of energy throughput per square kilometer, so to speak, of the Earth's surface than you get with any of these other forms of power generation. In other words, you're able to bring to bear a much more densely concentrated amount of power in a specific location, which then allows you to achieve much higher rates of production. You're able to follow through a certain, you're able to efficiently do things like desalination of water. There's certain kinds of industrial processes when you're talking about, you know, high-grade production of steels and things like this that require intense amounts of energy and high temperatures, which really can only be afforded whenever you introduce, you know, what is the most advanced level of technology, namely nuclear power. And then that, in turn, will then help create the context and the amount of free energy that's going to be necessary to move to then the next step, which is the fusion reactor development.
Right. So you're raising questions of the means to have large quantities of, literally produce sweet water out of salt water and do other things. And Ben, that you're out in Oakland there. If we're in a nuclear realm where there is plentiful energy, you also are in a situation where nuclear technologies for medicine and other purposes, this goes right along with it. Is that the kind of thing you've had a chance to look at with the accelerator in California?
I haven't toured that. We went there. We got to discuss. Didn't look at the medical aspect specifically, but it was very good when we got to go tour over in the Berkeley labs to see some of these technologies. And I would say some of the best work we've been doing with this is just the organizing around the development of nuclear power and these new technologies, like we saw over at the accelerator at the Berkeley lab, has been very useful in really giving people a sense of this idea of Lyndon LaRouche's concept, this idea of physical economics, as Cody was discussing. And it's been, the role of nuclear power specifically has been just very powerful in being able to actually demonstrate and give people a certain idea of that, of this actually being able to represent a, not just, you know, in the way of power, but really talking about a fundamental transformation in the way we can organize society as a whole, in the way we relate to the environment, natural resources and whatnot around us as a whole. And it's been, you know, a lot of fun. It's been very good organizing around that, around up in the Bay Area over here. We've had a lot of fun with that.
Well, one thing on the physical economy, the TANU has given special attention to water in India. This is kind of make or break.
Yeah, the, I mean that India is a, in a pretty large country with about 390 million hectares of land, but it's the it depends very heavily on a 9 weeks of rainy season, which is called the monsoon. And most of the water that India gets is basically from these 9 weeks, other than the summertime on the northern part where the Himalayas exist, the snow melt comes in. So there is a perpetual shortage of water in India, in anywhere in the hinterland of India. But India also has about 3,750 miles of coastal area. And one of the things that has now been accepted is that desalination for entire coastal areas would be the source for water, you know, water for commercial, domestic, and agricultural industrial use. And the problem with that otherwise is that, you know, it needs very high temperature in order to develop this, the, what they call flash desalination. You have a desalination in which you put in these membranes and the you know, salt water comes in, salt gets stopped in the way, and you know, the water comes out, the H2O. But this is a slow process, and that membrane is a very, very expensive item, and it is a very special item. And it, eventually it comes down as the production cost comes out pretty high, and a difficult one. But once you have the capability to generate high temperature, and that can create the flash, and then the water and salt can separate it in this flash process, desalination process, then water desalination becomes in a very easy, and you can have plentiful of water. Now, the thing that I think at this point in time what the Indians are seriously thinking is that developing small reactors. When I say small reactors, these are 50 to 100 megawatt reactors. They will be a sort of like a little package. They will go in there, and you can put them up near the coast, and that is going to a certain small area, the entire power, water, and other use that we have for power will be met. And in case the population grows in that area, your production capability grows in that area, agricultural capability grows in that area, you put in one of another one of those, so you can make a cluster. So these nuclear power plants, particularly the Pebble Bed Reactor, I had the good fortune of seeing that in Aachen in Germany, the Pebble Bed Reactor. These can be, you know, this can be put in anywhere you want. It doesn't need water for cooling or anything like that. It is gas cooled, so it can be put anywhere you want. And it is an absolute necessity for desalination, because when we are talking about large-scale desalination, we need a lot of heat and a lot of power. And these pebble bed reactors, and even ordinary, not ordinary, advanced heavy water reactors can generate that kind of heat. So one thing that has to be gotten across to the people is that nuclear power is not simply providing you electrical power, but is also providing you the means to generate good quality, clean, potable water, and also providing various types of isotopes, which can be used not only for industrial uses, but for medicinal purposes. So it has a multiple use, and all of these uses are greatly wanted in almost every society. So basically that's...
Right, and in Washington, D.C., I don't know if we want to switch into the from the sublime maybe to the ridiculous, the way Al Gore's got such a reception in Washington, D.C. recently, Cody. But you think there are certain... Is there a political expression of some understanding of what's involved in the physical economy here, or it's a question of organizing it around the country?
Yeah, it's going to take a great organizing effort, because most of our politicians are pretty much out to lunch on understanding the physical economy, let alone the physical principles which one utilizes in the process of developing a physical economy. I mean, it's typified by what you see now with the whole green movement, where, for example, this past week you had a debate between two people who you would think ostensibly are on opposite ends of the spectrum, John Kerry, former Democratic candidate for president, and Newt Gingrich, right, the Contract on America, former Speaker of the House. Well, the two of them had a debate where the premise of the debate was they both fundamentally agree that global warming is occurring. It's a function of human-created CO2. And the real debate was what kind of mechanism would be best for moving the nation away from industrial production, away from the emission of CO2, towards the kind of quote-unquote green technologies that will eliminate CO2 emission, namely wind power, biofuels, this kind of insanity. So, you know, these guys they're totally out to lunch, which I think is why Mr. LaRouche keeps emphasizing that the only thing that's going to move this process along is a mass movement of young people who, in effect, kick the butts of the boomers and tell them, look, this is where we're going, and if you want to survive, you better get on board and allow us to drag you kicking and screaming to a brighter future.
You're right. I think that debate, which got a lot of publicity because of being on C-SPAN, you know, I mean, it was repeated a lot, does epitomize what you say, this insanity, that Gingrich would speak of incentivizing the markets to go green, mm-hmm. and Kerry's false debate was regulating the markets to go green or something like that.
Yeah.
But in, Ben, this is what you're talking about in California, that bringing to young people the issue of the real economy, or engaging them, excuse me, in thinking about what is truth. Is that what you were getting at?
Yeah. Yeah, it's just been, we've been seeing it. There has been, especially among the young people, there is a growing openness to things like nuclear power and a certain recognition for what this really means as a potential for mankind as a whole. And you do see a difference, like Cody was saying, when organizing the young people compared to the baby boomer generation around these ideas of development with nuclear power. And we've been doing a lot of work focusing on really trying to give people a concept of what this means in terms of physical economics, like what kind of transformation fundamentally we can create in the economies of the world and in our relationship to the environment around us, what completely new potentials we can have for supporting populations at much higher living standards as a function of, you know, specifically the role of nuclear power in that. And there is definitely a growing movement within the younger generation that we're educating or leading that's coming to understand that.
Well, one example from what you and Tanu have been saying about the whole transformation in the physical economy, if you're really going nuclear, was shown by there was testimony presented in the parliament in Denmark about having a whole magnetically levitated rail project there. And I encourage people to look. They can get the whole testimony on the website, larouchepack.com. But how would you power that? Obviously, you can't do it through windmills, even right up in the Baltic there, when they have a lot of storms. Mm-hmm. And so that in terms of the transportation transformation, that if you're going to do it, it's nuclear power on site where you then can power the magnetic power.
Right.
And so forth. But so people should definitely read that, speaking of transforming the political process, as Ben was just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
This is the kind of thing we want to make available. Cody, maybe you even want to say something about the new hour-by-hour LaRouche Youth Movement running the website for this kind of political impact?
Yeah, well, under the direction of Lynn, he basically gave the directive that we had to get the website, the LaRouche PAC website, up to par with what the audience that we're most trying to reach out to, namely the 18 to 35-year-olds, what kind of format is most accommodating to them? And that is one where you have a constantly updating and changing website. Because as has been indicated, most people know that young people spend more and more of their time reading, if they read at all, reading off of websites, off of the Internet. And so what we've had is we brought in a team of three or so people into the National Center to run the website, where it's constantly being updated based on a function of what the intelligence team in the National Center is doing in conjunction with the War Room, which is the youth grouping which sort of organizes, coordinates activity nationally amongst the youth movement. Then those updated ideas are then sent to the people in the who are running the LPAC site, who are constantly keeping this thing moving, updated on a minute-to-minute, hour-to-hour basis to serve the function so that people can effectively turn to the LPAC site as the leading source of up-to-minute news, strategic insight, breaking developments. And so far, it's already started to have tremendous impacts on actually changing how things unfold strategically. You know, for instance, Al Gore having to dump his sponsorship of Barrick Gold, which was sponsoring his trip to South America to speak on global warming, because we exposed the fact that here's a, you know, quote-unquote dirty polluter, you know, Barrick Gold, the Bush family, Nazi ties, etc. We blew that story, and it created such a stink that Al Gore had to give up his $500,000 pay and look for new sponsors.
Right. Yeah, what you're referring to, people should know, is that in Santiago, Chile, Al Gore has this speaking event, and I mm-hmm. think out of $200,000, his fee or his cost, $50,000 was to come from Barrick Gold. And so after the LaRouche PAC limb breaking news was exposing the Barrick Gold connection, the people organizing the event had to refuse the money and sever the tie.
Uh-huh.
So, and you're right, that's an hour-by-hour thing. Another example, and that brings us back to this whole question of making way for the nuclear renaissance, clearing the way of this craziness. You know, you've not just had Al Gore around, you've had Arnold Schwarzenegger's on an international platform. He's given a script by the people who put him in anyway, George Shultz and these types. He made an East Coast tour this week. But in fact, Cody, your FDR Legacy Club is forcing the debate in California out in the open, correct? On what kind of hoax global warming is, but what kind of energy, what kind of policy we ought to have, right?
Yeah, that's correct. At the LA County Central Committee, we had put together a resolution questioning the. You know, questioning the support of the Democratic Party of green power and Al Gore and whatnot. You know, discussing his racist roles in Tennessee, his role in Africa of trying to stop the production of generic AIDS medication in South Africa, and then also just questioning the science behind global warming in the IPCC study. This then initially got tabled at the Central Committee meeting because there's certain, obviously, of people within the Democratic Party who are still anti-LaRouche. But what it did is it created a debate where the head of the chairman of the Central Committee actually denounced the person who tabled the resolution after we had first put forth the initial arguments. They then tabled it because they didn't want to debate the science. But now it's created a condition where going into the state Democratic convention coming up at the end of the month, we're now in a position where we're going to be running around gathering up to 300 signatures to get a resolution that would actually go into, that would be on the table for the state Democratic Party resolution committee to be an official resolution of the state party of California.
Right, and that the text of that resolution, I just checked a couple hours ago, is available then on LaRouchePAC.com. And so anyone wanting to be in a position to draw the line and create a fight, whether in Ontario or Mexico or in Asia, you got it. At this time, I need to make the half-hour program announcement just to repeat that you are listening to The LaRouche Show. This is April 14, 2007. We are weekly on Saturdays from 3 to 4 Eastern Time in the United States. And I encourage everyone to be checking both the LaRouche publication site, EIR News Service, that's LaRouchePub.com, LaRouchePub.com, where this weekly LaRouche show comes. And otherwise, we've been referring to this transformed and transformational LaRouchePAC.com. That's LaRouchePAC.com site, in order to take this fighting ammunition that's being put there every day. The toll-free number, if you want to call during the week for any reason, is 800-929-7566. And that raises the resources question. You need to subscribe to contribute early and often to make what's being described, to really ensure that it happens, because this can make all the difference. And what I'd like to do now, in the continuing discussion, is either, unless Ben or Cody want to throw something in right now, make sure we cover, Tanu, the on the thorium question. India is a bit unique, I think, in the geology of the planet, where I think Colorado and the Carolinas here in North America have some thorium or ore. But India has this plentiful, special kind of...
Brazil, Australia, and India.
Okay. And so so what you described about the size, these small, compact...
Reactors,
mm-hmm. But they would use thorium to then breed uranium.
Right. Now, the thorium is basically a non-fissile material, which is also known as the fissionable material. That means you can make a fissile material out of thorium. Thorium is 232. Now, when thorium atom gets hit by a neutron, it becomes thorium-233, and within a few seconds, it goes into there's a beta decay takes place, and it becomes uranium-233. And then uranium-233 in that form remains for about 27 and a half days, and then another beta decay occurs, and then it becomes non-fissionable protactinium. Now, the thorium, for these reasons, and thorium was not plentiful in the Western countries, where, of course, nuclear power development research work was done. The more obvious one was uranium-238, which is also plentiful, but less so than thorium on this Earth. And this Earth, the maximum amount of ore that you get is bauxite, which is aluminum, and number two is thorium. So thorium should be very important for nuclear development, but for reasons that were, at that point in time was different, uranium-238 and uranium-235 were the material for a nuclear fission. U-238, within absorbing a neutron, becomes plutonium-239, which is highly fissile, and uranium-235, which is available in nature in about 0.7% in a clump of U-238, is also highly fissile material. Now, thorium research was therefore not done in West, and India, of course, is one of India's characteristic is that India never signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. NPT, which was set up in 1968 and actually ratified in 1970, was based upon that you have to, if you sign this treaty, then you cannot develop nuclear weapons, you cannot do nuclear weapons tests, and also that you have to get enriched uranium. Either you have the permission to do the enrichment of uranium, or you have to get enriched uranium from somebody else. So, in essence, other than those who have the capability to have the enriched uranium or the capability to enrich uranium, they will basically hold the control the nuclear program of everybody else. So, from the word get-go, the Indians said that this is a faulty treaty. This is 1968 was also made the cutoff point. Countries which had tested nuclear weapons till 1968 were given the status of nuclear weapon states. Nobody else can enter that, you know, that sanctum sanctorum. So the five nations were thus became the nuclear weapon states: United States, Russia, China, Britain, and France. They had all tested their nuclear weapons before 1968. And this was also another sticking point for the Indians. They said, you know, there is absolutely no reason why Britain and France should be nuclear weapon states and other large nations like Brazil, India, and others are being kept out permanently. And this is a permanent thing. And the other issue that was also that was put in NPT, which the Indians objected to, was that one of the things, Article 6 in the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty said that after the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty is signed, the duty of all the five nuclear weapon states will be to reduce their nuclear weapons. And we know during the Cold War what happened. Everybody jacked up their nuclear weapon production. So Indians said this is a deliberate lie and which is being perpetuated and by these nuclear weapon states. Hence, we are not going to sign it. But as a result, what the Indians had to go through is to reinventing the wheel, because everything that was available for nuclear research and development were shut off. So Indians had to develop their own scientists, own research lab, own everything, and create their own nuclear program. And at that point in time, since India doesn't have uranium, they have a little, and thorium was plentiful, the decision was made that all this research and development should be geared to making thorium as the center of fuel, main fuel for India's future nuclear reactor development. So that was the issue on that. And there was, since nobody else had thorium, nobody was doing work on thorium, this didn't become a problematic thing because India couldn't get any of this research information or anything from anybody else. So in a sense, that worked out fine. But now they are in a position to, they have made thorium a fissile material, they have gone through everything and they have done their thing. Now the major decision that is to be made and is now being made, and we are playing a role in that, is that whether these thorium reactors should be exclusively for to be made for large power generation, which will be utilized for industrial development. However, you know, India is a mostly an agrarian society. Agricultural, 60% of its workforce are in the agricultural sector. So agriculture has to be, it is being now being understood that agricultural sector should have exclusive rights to power. And that should be not being drawn in from the urban areas where these large nuclear plants should be, but they should be located in agricultural area. And this will be not only for power to the agricultural area, but also for desalination of seawater and brackish water. There's a lot of brackish water exists in India. That means the groundwater, which is contains enormous number of minerals, and which you cannot use for agricultural purposes, and a lot of varieties of salts which would destroy your agricultural producers instantly. So a lot of brackish water can be converted back into sweet water, and now it is being understood that these power plants have to be stationed in agricultural area. But then again, in agricultural area, since the industrial requirement is less, the power plant sizes are, you don't need that much of power. So in two or three varieties of thorium reactors are now being considered. One is definitely of the size of 700 to 750. Another
megawatts.
Megawatt. Another will be around 230 to 250. And the third variety will be about 50 to 100. And these will be, and 50 to 100 will be mostly in the agricultural areas and the coastal areas for desalination of water, providing the population with the power that is necessary for their infrastructure, which is railroads, education, healthcare, and everything else. But another idea has come up, and this is the Indians and Russians are now combining together to do this research. This will be a very interesting area of work. In fact, it exists in U.S. With the uranium as fuel in Lawrence Livermore. It is the acronym of that is STAAR, STAR. The concept is that you take a nuclear power plant, it's like it's a sealed thing. So it's a breeder reactor, in fact. So you put the fuel in there, and through a mechanism that you develop, the fuel will be in different compartment, and you will be, once the fuel is burnt out from one compartment, you will expose the next compartment, and then you, as that burns out, you expose another compartment. This way, without touching this reactor, you can go on using the power for 30 years, and that at the end of the 30 years, there is no fuel left in this. At that point in time, you have two options. Either you can open up the sealed reactor and reprocess the fuel, and if in most of the cases, you will be getting back about 90 to 95% of uranium by reprocessing, or you can just bury it because it's a sealed unit. It will not, never, ever will be, will leak out any radioactivity that is inside. So it will be sealed units, and this will be of the size of, it depends on what size of reactor you are making, but if you have capacity, if you are talking about 50 megawatt, it will be about 15 feet in diameter and about 40 feet in height, and it's about, 200 ton. And so you can bury it, one after another underground in, particularly in area which are sandy areas and all that. So, but the way this research can go on in this area, you can increase their lifespan from 30 to 40 to 50 to 60. So you can have these reactors sealed and, you start it off and then 50 years later, you switch it off and bury it. And this is, this is Edward Teller, the great, nuclear scientist of the United States, often considered as the father of hydrogen bomb. Teller had this in mind. Teller had done this work and for burial purpose, and he had.
Oh, he'll be right with us. Yeah. Keep going.
Excuse me. And he had designed a thing which is a very shiny mirror, metal mirror inside the reactor, which will reflect the neutron back to hit the fuel. The fuels will be there, and then the mirrors will open as the neutron goes and hits the mirror. Mirror reflects it back into the fuel. Now, a mirror can be just like an elevator, can be lifted up slowly over the years, and the fuels are stacked up. Only when the mirror is in line with it, the neutron can go and hit it. So it's a very interesting design. But in the United States, by the time, Teller did this, it was early 80s. By that time, late 70s, by that time it was already dead. Nobody was talking about nuclear And Edward Teller was considered as an ogre who is the creator of the hydrogen bomb and all that kind of thing. But this was a wonderful idea, and it has come back again. I do not know exactly how the star is doing that. Probably they have taken some of these Teller's ideas, and they have put probably new ideas that have come through and new materials that have come through. But in the Indian case, that the Indian and the Russian development that is going on, there will be in separate compartments, and these compartments will be like with a little sluice gate. You open up the gate, and a fuel will be exposed. Then you sort of and there is a lever which will automatically, after burning, will automatically after 5 years, for example, it will drop. So the next line of fuel will become exposed, and it's an interesting concept, but you know, it needs work. And once this is being done, I believe that a lot of fear about two things will happen. One is that every nuclear power plant every year gets a fuel loading. It's usually 12 months, 14 months, it depends. And that plant has to be shut down. And the shutdown goes on for, you know, 7 days, 8 days, 10 days. And usually what happens, since I worked in a nuclear power plant, I know that every other complaint in that plant that was building up, say, for 1 year, is taken care of in one go when the shutdown is done. So usually a 7 day shutdown extends to about 21 days, 22 days. Now, in case of this kind of sealed nuclear power plant, there will be no shutdown. It is automatic. So you will not lose even a single hour of power supply in the entire 30 years. Now that's, you know, if you say that to an industrialist, he will jump in joy and he will just, you know, he will bless you forever, because this is a big problem for every big industry to deal with when the power is cut down. The second thing that will happen is that safety question. Every time you shut down a nuclear power plant, take the fuel out, there is a possibility, because inside that fuel now, plutonium and all this bomb-making material are being created. And so there is always this constant fear, quote-unquote fear, by these, and the propaganda by the greenies, is that there is no way the safety can be fully assured, because people can take out material, it cannot be accounted for, and will be used for bomb making. And this is another excuse for bomb making, that you load and unload and reload and all that. Now all these things are gone. These things are completely gone, because it is sealed. It will never be opened. And if the decision is being made that it will be buried sealed, then you will never see that fuel ever again in a million years. So it's a safety point of view, and the greenish propaganda point of view. These are very good weapons that we have. And secondly, for the industries and everybody, domestic and commercial use, uninterrupted power supply is the best thing that one can think of. So these ideas are now coming in. Now, one thing one must also remember, that nuclear power is not just power itself, and as I said, you know, isotopes and desalination. But more important than that, the nuclear power technology itself is a pretty complex technology, and it requires materials which are of very high quality, in the sense corrosion resistance, temperature resistant, and it needs extremely high level of polishing. The kind of alloys that you need are extremely rare, because they have extremely high temperature resistant capacity, like zirconium. And extraction of these processes, and these, you know, brings up the technology level of any country, any society, to a very high level. It's not simply the knowledge and education, but physical technology level that you need in order to build a nuclear power plant, and in order to build and to maintain it, is a different parameter stuff we're talking about than the coal-fired plant and all that. They're nothing against coal-fired plants. They do a wonderful job. But the point is that we are talking about educating an entire generation through the process of this technology development. And that's the beauty of this high-tech, what is commonly and loosely being said high-tech items, that it's a process in which you learn materials, which is, I think, the most important thing to learn. And the second thing that you learn is that how to process them. And you have to come up with zillions of different processes. And every day, a new process comes up, which enhances the productivity, reduces the waste, which in the process reduces pollution. And these are the challenges that you are always, you have to face when you are dealing with high technology material, which is involved in nuclear power plants.
Well, this is very exciting. And Cody, you visited one of the places where some exciting work on fourth generation plants are going on. But maybe you have a question about this thorium cycle in particular, or otherwise the high temperature gas cooling instead of steam water cooling.
Well, I guess I was just wondering what the fundamentally in terms of the fuel that's used, the difference between the use of, say, thorium versus the uranium-235. What's the kind of one of the obviously the big problem that the populace have is around the idea of the breeder reactors, because that one seemingly has the potential to then have weapons-grade plutonium come out of it versus, you know, other kinds of reactors. What is the whole debate there around the different types of fuels to be used?
Well, basically, what you have in nature is when you take a clump of uranium-238, you will find about 0.7% of that is uranium-235, which is fissile material, bomb-making material. But 0.7% enrichment, you cannot do anything with that other than you can run a nuclear reactor, which is called the heavy water reactor and all that. But you have to enrich it up to a point of 7 to 8% in order to run the standard reactors that you see here, which were manufactured previously by Westinghouse and General Electric, the pressurized water reactor and boiling water reactors. You need a 7% enrichment. So what you do is that you convert this U-238 into uranium oxide, U-308. This is basically a powder, and which you then float in the air, and the heavier uranium-238 is heavier, falls off. That's what the centrifuge does. It rotates in a very fast way, and the heavier one falls off, and uranium-235 stays. So over a period of time, after running it through zillions of centrifuges, you come to a point where uranium-235 is 7%, and you were okay, now we can use it for pressurized water reactor, this thing. But still, you have 7% uranium-235 and 93% uranium-238 when you make that fuel bundle. And when the fuel bundle gets exposed to neutrons and then the fuel is burned, you will find a lot of PU-239, plutonium-239, which is, after absorbing one neutron by uranium-238, it becomes plutonium-239. So plutonium-239 you didn't make it. It doesn't exist in nature, but it was created in the nuclear reactor. And so this, now when you change the fuel, you put in new fuel, now you have this used fuel in which plutonium-239 is sitting there. So this is the way the plutonium-239 is being then taken out through the reprocessing method to use for nuclear weapons and this kind of stuff. So that will be there. That will be always there. And in case of thorium-233, there is thorium-232 that is being used for thorium. You will be making uranium-233. Now, the uranium-233 is a fissile material, but unlike plutonium-239, which has a half-life of some 500,000 years or something like that, I don't have it in my head, uranium-233 has 27 days. So the bomb-making, you have to use that uranium-233 within 27 days. So if you make the bomb today, and within 27 days you have to use it. So that way, the storage of bombs and things like that, which is usually is being done, is not possible. So that is one of the reasons that why a lot of people, a lot of scientists will point out that use of thorium is much safer because you do not have that bomb-making material available. It's only available for 27 days. Now, you want to go to a war today and want to use nuclear weapons, yes, you can take the U-233, which is now getting developed in this thorium fuel reactors. You can use that. But for planning for a war, and most of the nuclear weapons that you have in the arsenal are sitting there for years and years. Now, with plutonium, that's fine. But you cannot do with uranium-233. You can do with uranium-235, but not with uranium-233. So that's one of the strong points of thorium-232. Now, in the Brita reactor or any other reactor, you will be getting plutonium. There is no question. Once you have put uranium-238 in there, you will get plutonium. No matter what you do, that they will absorb the neutron and there will be plutonium-239. Whether it's a Brita reactor or a nuclear reactor, just a power reactor, you will have plutonium-239. The point is, plutonium-239 is also a wonderful trigger for starting off a lot of other reactors. Because, for example, to start a reaction, you need some fissile material to come along with it. And so plutonium-239 can be used and is used as a triggering mechanism to start a chain reaction within a nuclear reactor. It's all can be done. The point is that these things are God's gift to us. And you want to utilize it, and the people who want nuclear power generation for the sake of betterment of the society, they'll point out that all these can be done, but you want to utilize in a wrong way. Yes, it can be done too, and whether it is done or not, the fear of that can be done can be created, and that's all I can say.
Does that make sense, Cody?
Yeah, very much. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. And on this, back to Ben, do you have any particular questions on this?
I had a question specifically on the importance of these smaller reactors.
Mm-hmm.
I was curious if you could elaborate the importance of these for developing regions which don't have much of an infrastructure set up.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is that these can be set up with much less necessity for prior infrastructure,
yeah,
and can be just put up. And if you could elaborate on that.
Yeah, that's true, because when you build a 1,000 megawatt nuclear reactor, the amount of infrastructure, I'm talking about roads and buildings and construction and cooling tower and all this kind of thing that you have to do, is not only enormously costly, but also it takes an enormous amount of area. And there are a lot of areas where people do not want a huge, humongous stuff like that being brought in and disrupted their way of life. So with a small reactor, you have, having a substation in your area. You must have seen a substation. Just in the middle of a shopping mall, you can see a substation. It'll be just like that. Secondly, the most important thing to me is that when you have a large reactor and a large amount of power is generated, you have to put it on a grid system. Now, a lot of these small countries and even middle-sized countries do not have a national grid. And if you don't have the national grid, you cannot pump in huge amount of power into whatever grid you have, because the grid system is like, you have to consider it's like a pipe, water pipe. You cannot put enormous amount of water in a small pipe. It doesn't work. So the grid system gets completely destabilized, and unlike power water pipe analogy that I gave, a power system, when it gets unstable, it breaks off. That means you will get complete collapse of power. So when you put a large system in there, into a grid, you must have a very strong grid, very well-designed grid, very big grid, so that it can take in that huge amount of power. Then, for example, if the nuclear reactor you are shutting down, that this power is not coming in. So the grid must be able to absorb that as well. Otherwise, another grid will collapse. In a small power plant, you will generate the power and use the power there. You will not be putting anything on grid. So that's the idea.
Well, I thank you all. It's hard to believe the hour flew by. But I thank Cody Jones, Ben Denniston, and Tanu Maitra for being with us April 14th, 2007, and encourage and harangue everyone to please check early and often the LaRouchePack.com website and bring about the change we're talking about for a future for civilization. Tune back in April 21st from 3 to 4 on Saturday at LaRouchePub.com. And thank you all very much.
Thank you. Thank you.